You pick up your Bible and wonder, is there more here than meets the eye? Is there anything here for me? I mean, it's just words printed on paper, right? Well, it may look like just print on a page, but it's more than ink. Join us for the next half hour as we explore God's Word together, as we learn how to explore it on our own, as we ask God to meet us there in its pages. Welcome to More Than Ink.
You know, when a person was crucified, they would put a sign above the person's head to say what crime that they had committed.
Well, and in the case of a person like Jesus, you would expect that to be a false accusation, because everybody knew he was innocent.
But in this particular case, as we look at the crucifixion today, what was written there was absolutely the truth, and we'll look at it today on More Than Ink.
Well, good morning. This is More Than Ink. You found us at our dining room table where we always are with our Bibles open to talk about this particular passage. We are right in the middle of chapter 27 of Matthew, and we are looking at the crucifixion of Jesus.
We finally come to the crucifixion after a couple of weeks leading up to it, and here we are.
It's going to take us a couple of weeks to get through it.
Yeah.
Which seems appropriate because crucifixion was a prolonged form of execution.
Right.
It took hours and hours for a crucified person to die, and it was very public. It was extremely humiliating and probably one of the most painful means of execution known to mankind.
Yeah. A long time ago, I read a description by Cicero, who was he was in the Roman Senate, and he went on record about how cruel it was, and he's absolutely right. I mean, it's horrible, but it's also meant to be a warning to the populace that unless you straighten up, this is going to happen to you. And so in that process of having someone put on the cross, it was always made very clear why it was they were there. And many times it was written on the cross. Sometimes it was put on a sign around their neck.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see that today as well. Because remember, this is a warning to everyone else. Don't go down this road or this will happen to you.
And it was done in a public place.
Very
along a road
public.
Or coming in and out of the city.
Yep.
So that everyone who came would see and know. Don't mock the Romans.
That's right. Just like we find places to put billboards today where lots of people will see them. The Romans put crucifixions where lots of people would see them. So, and when we left last time in chapter 27 of Matthew, all the hearings with the magistrates, with Pilate, that was all done. And finally, at the very end of that, he released Jesus to the soldiers, and they've got him today. And now they're going to be in the process of taking him to the crucifixion.
Well, they sent him, Pilate sent him to be scourged.
Yes.
Which we probably need to review a little bit. That scourging was such a violent whipping with a whip that was embedded with bits of metal or bone that it would lay open the skin, sometimes as deep as the bone or the internal organs.
Right.
And many people who were scourged by the Romans died in the scourging. They never made it to
the
crucifixion.
It was often fatal. But if it's not fatal, what I always tell people is it brings you right up in the edge of going into shock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's brutally painful. There's circulatory shock issues. I mean, it's brutal. And that's where Jesus is now. And he's in the hand of the soldiers. And their instructions from Pilate was crucify him. And that's where we pick up the story today in Matthew 27, verse 27, with the soldiers and Jesus.
Okay. Verse 27, then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus to the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him and led him away to crucify him.
Man, if they only knew who this was, you know, it's a remarkable thing. So this is an entertainment for the soldiers. They're indulging in a little entertainment before they put this guy to death and put him on the cross. And so it's interesting. They bring Jesus out of the public view and to the inside of Pilate's courthouse in a way, the praetorium, where they do all their business.
Where they
for
can
the
have
area.
Their fun with him.
Yeah, so no one will see him doing this. So they go in there and they dress him up like a mock king. They give him a royal robe. They give him a reed to act as a scepter that you hold in your right hand. And then they put a crown on him, and it's not a regular crown made of gold. It's a crown made of thorns. So it's meant to be a torture device. And as they're there, seated in this regalia of mockery of the king of the Jews, they actually mock him by kneeling down and worshiping him, but they're not worshiping him. They're not paying heed to him. They're mocking him. And this is their entertainment for the day.
Well, and as a representative of the Jews, you know, spitting on him, beating him, expresses their utter contempt for the people they were in power over.
Yeah. In fact, it goes from just an indulgence of mockery to a real cruelty at that point when the spitting happens, a real cruelty. And then they even take the reed out of his right hand, this false scepter, and start hitting him with it. Mm-hmm. And the language that Matthew uses here means to continually do it over and over and over again. So they take this symbol of power, even though it's just a reed, and they smite him with it, saying, "Your power is used against you." So everything in here is cruel, and it's mocking, and it's entertainment for them. That's what they're doing with him right now. It's cruel. But, you know, it's also an artifact of what looks like an imbalance of power. Those with great power, like these military soldiers, they hold all the power in this situation and think that they can use that to indulge in this mockery. What they don't understand is that the one that they're mocking and that they're using their power over is the one who created the universe. Mm-hmm. If they knew what they were doing, they wouldn't even think about doing this. And so it's a visible reminder to us that Jesus, who is the powerful creator of the universe, could easily have turned this around in a heartbeat. The Roman soldiers had no power over him.
Yeah, you know, before we close today, we might circle back and read Philippians 2, where Paul says he humbled himself, even to the point of death on a cross.
Yeah. So... It's
just hard to read.
It's just hard to read. It's just hard to read. And
even though we read these words, but we don't have pictures for them, right? We have no frame of reference for crucifixion today our country in general.
Yeah, nothing that publicly cruel.
No.
Yeah, designed as
probably have isolated incidences, but not a governmental system of this kind of public humiliation.
Oh,
and
yeah, that our government would ever endorse.
Right.
Yeah. And it's also, this raises an interesting question in my mind. I've never thought about this before, but with them pulling Jesus into the praetorium, into this private space where the public can't see him, technically speaking, none of his followers are watching this.
No
one would have seen this. So how did Matthew get this account? It would have had to come from one of the soldiers. And why would one of the soldiers ever tell Matthew? Maybe he became a believer.
Because he came to believe in Jesus. And we know that there were centurions who believed in Jesus throughout his ministry.
There were.
So it's possible that they were there behind the scenes or present but not active. We just don't know.
We just don't know. But it must have come from someone who was inside the praetorium who watched this.
You know, that makes me think of Joseph of Arimathea that we're going to read about in a couple of weeks, about how he came earlier to believe in Jesus, but it was the actual death of Jesus that caused him to become public about his faith.
That's right. Yeah,
so,
that's right.
So, that's interesting.
Kind of draws you out. Yeah. And so before we push on, I might just point out what this parade looks like. They led him away to crucify him. They often picked the longest route in town. Again, to advertise the fact that this man is being punished for the crimes that are on the sign he's actually carrying around his neck or they're showing. And so there would usually be a soldier, a centurion in the front on a horse, and then there would be the one who's going to be crucified with the men around him. And normally, it only took 4 soldiers to do this. There might have been more. So he's led through town, and someone as a herald will actually read out loud, "This person is being crucified because he's a thief or he's a robber," or something like that. So Jesus is paraded through town as they make these false accusations. However, it's not a false accusation. All he can say is what's on the sign. He's being killed because he's the king of the Jews. Yeah, and that's what the town will see. So let's pick up the narrative in 32.
Okay, verse 32. "As they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, and they compelled this man to carry his cross. But we'll, let's stop there for a minute.
That's an interesting detail.
Cyrene is in North Africa.
It's right at the top tip of Libya.
Okay, and why would Jesus have needed someone else to carry his cross? Because he had been so abused and beaten and loss of blood and shock
the
and
scourging.
Exhaustion.
Yeah, most likely.
And probably the pole he was carrying would have weighed maybe 30, 40 pounds.
Yeah.
So he simply may not have been physically able
to do it. Well, clearly he wasn't. Clearly he wasn't. So they needed to find Simon, who's some stranger. He's probably just in town for Passover. I mean,
But we have his name.
He's in, you know, he lives 1,000 miles away, roughly. So he's in town
for
this.
He's probably come for the Passover.
Right. Mm-hmm. However, there is an interesting distinction in Mark's gospel.
Yeah.
Because it turns out that Mark's gospel tells us the names of Simon's sons.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting? And when something like that happens, it's usually because later in the early life of the church, people would recognize those names. Mm-hmm. Maybe his sons actually came to faith in Christ and were part of the faith community there. And then one of the two names is actually used by Paul in the end of Romans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's Rufus, right?
Yeah.
So could it be that Simon, as he watches this and carries Jesus' cross, his two sons end up becoming followers of Jesus, or at least one of them, Rufus by name, but we don't really know. But that's a fascinating little tidbit. You don't give names usually when you have kind of walk-in characters in the narrative.
This is just a nobody, right?
Especially the guy's son's name. So that's an interesting little information there. So they compelled him to carry the cross. Let's move on.
So, and it was not probably a level journey. You go up and down little hills and
round
corners walking through the old city in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Verse 33, and when they came to a place called Golgotha, which means place of a skull, they offered him wine to drink mixed with gall. But when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. And over his head, they put the charge against him, which read, "This is the King of the Jews." Let's stop there.
Yeah, there's the charge. There's the accusation. That's why he's on the cross.
Right. There is no king but Caesar.
That's
which the people had actually cried out, "We only serve Caesar.
Yeah.
We don't want any other king."
Yeah, yeah. And remember back in John's gospel, the religious leaders take a little offense at this title on the sign because they say, no,
right.
Don't put that. Say that he claimed to be. And of course, Pilate in John 19 says, no, I put what I put. So deal with it. This is the conflict between them showing up right there, too.
So at this point in Matthew's account, we begin to have phrase after phrase after phrase that are references to fulfilled prophecy.
Yeah, it's true.
From Psalm 22, from Psalm 69, from Isaiah 53. And if you are just learning to be a Bible student, I would encourage you as you read this account, check out those cross-references in the column
You'll
of
see
your
that
Bible.
Either center or side column on the page.
That's because we won't maybe take time to track down them
That's
all.
That's what they're trying to tell you about in those, is check this out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are there. And if we have time before we finish today, perhaps we'll read one or two of those passages.
Yeah,
But the first one that really drew my attention coming in here was about offering him wine to drink that's mixed with gall.
Mm-hmm,
and that
mm-hmm.
verse comes out of Psalm 69, verse 21.
Yeah, yeah.
When he tasted it, he wouldn't drink it. So gall was poison.
Uh-huh.
And so what would have been the purpose of offering him that? Would it have been to continue to weaken him so he would not resist crucifixion? Or was it a drug that would cause him to take longer to die?
We don't really know. I mean, a lot of speculation is that it would numb the pain of the process.
But whatever it was, he tasted it and said, I need to be wholly conscious.
Yep. I want to be fully in this is what he's doing. By the way, a little tidbit before we go on. The Greek word for place of the skull is Golgotha. You know what the Latin word for place of the skull is? The Latin word is Calvary.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we use those two words synonymously. Yeah.
So the place of the skull. You know, if you've been to Israel, you've seen. They take you, all the tourists go there to this hillside that has eroded a great deal in the last couple of centuries. But it gives the appearance of a skull.
It looks kind of.
It's possible that is what Matthew is referring to. But it could also have been just a recognized place of execution.
It could. It totally could. Yeah, the first time I went to Israel, I looked out my window from the from the hotel I was staying in, the north side of the old city, and mm-hmm. looked out, and there was a bus station below me, you know, asphalt and buses. And the hillside behind it was this very thing yeah. that people say it probably looked like this.
And there is a beautiful garden that has been established there, yes. and it's called the Garden Tomb. Right. And it is a representational place.
Yeah.
Nobody knows if it's actually the tomb that Jesus was laid in, but it is a good place to just sit and consider
yep.
the events of the crucifixion really and their significance.
Yeah, it's really true.
Okay, and when they had crucified him, they divided his garments among them by casting lots. Again, directly fulfillment of Psalm 22:18.
Yep. Totally.
Then they sat down and kept watch over him there. Verse 37. And over his head they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, King of the Jews." Mm. It's interesting. It says, "This is Jesus. This is Yeshua. This is God saves."
God saves
the King of the Jews. Jews.
I mean, it's totally truthful. I've almost said, I wish I could go into that situation and point at the sign and say, "People, read the sign."
That's right.
That's the only thing telling the truth right here is this sign.
So then we come into the account of the two robbers who were crucified with him. Again, Isaiah 53:12 says he was numbered with wicked men. Mm-hmm. So verse 38, then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those who passed by derided him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So also the chief priests with the scribes and elders mocked him, saying, "He saved others. He can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross, and we'll believe in him. Mm. He trusts in God. Let God deliver him now if he desires him. For he said, 'I am the Son of God.'" And the robbers who were crucified with him also reviled him in the same way.
Wait, both robbers?
Well, this is where you need to go and read the account that Luke gives, because Luke comes this far, and then he adds in chapter 23 of Luke, he adds a turn in the story.
One of them changes his mind.
Somewhere during these hours on the cross,
yeah.
one of these men came to believe in Jesus. Yeah. Do you have that passage in front of you?
I don't have it in front of me, but it's just a great story. And there's two gospels claim that both other robbers were mocking Jesus. So that's just isn't one of them. Two of them claim both were doing it, at the beginning at least.
But somebody Luke talked to was close enough to hear this exchange. And we know that many of the people who followed Jesus were around in the crowd at the crucifixion.
Yeah.
Here I have it in Luke 23. Starting in verse 39. One of the criminals who were hanged there with him, hurling abuse at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself in us and us." But the other said, rebuking him, "Do you not even fear God, since you're under the same sentence of condemnation? We indeed justly, for we're receiving what we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done no wrong." Isn't that interesting? That's the same thing Pilate said. He hasn't done any wrong.
Right.
Verse 42, and he was saying, Jesus, Yeshua, remember me when you come in your kingdom.
Mm.
So there he is with his dying breath saying, "I know God saves, and you are the King."
Yeah.
Verse 43, and Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise."
Mm. That brief exchange is one of the most astonishing ones in the whole
powerful.
Bible. I mean, I asked myself, how did this robber change his mind? What did he see? What did he hear? And on top of that, how did he know that Jesus was indeed a king? And how did he know that he was going to come into his kingdom after his death? Mm-hmm. That means his kingdom is not of this world.
He may have heard the teachings of Jesus prior to this, but he was too busy pursuing his theft.
And then why in the world would he ever think that he could actually ask Jesus to be part of that when he indeed was being killed for what he had done wrong? Why would he think Jesus would say, "Sorry, buddy, you know, you're a sinner. That's why you're on this cross." You know, why did he think he had even a hope of a chance that Jesus would accept him? I mean, all of that is wrapped up in that one little sentence of extraordinary awareness about the Savior who is the King whose kingdom is to come. I mean, it's just, and that he could potentially have a place in it. I mean, it's an astonishing thing.
And Jesus responds to him. Yeah. Jesus says, today, you're going to be with me.
You will be with me.
You know, that makes me think of Hebrews 12, says, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, right? He fully experienced that agony as a human being, but he was looking right past it.
For the joy
set before
him. To
where he was going to be.
Yeah. And this is not a pleasant experience, but the joy that comes after that is because of what it's going to accomplish.
And that's what motivated him, right? Yeah. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. It's fascinating to look at this mocking while he's on the cross, because people will say, well, I've read the Bible, and Jesus never claimed to be God.
They haven't really read it.
Well, here's an account of his enemies testifying. They got what he said. They got what he said because they used it against him to mock him. So don't ever let anyone say Jesus never said that, because his enemies got
it. Clearly he did.
His enemies caught it, and they used that to make fun of him. Yeah, you who would destroy the temple, if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. And all these things they're saying, he could do all these things. Mm-hmm. Again, he voluntarily stays put on the cross because for the joy set before him, he endured it. He endured it because of what was going to happen in terms of bringing many to glory with him.
Mm. Yeah. This is the same kind of mocking that still goes on today, right?
Oh, yeah.
If you're the Son of God, prove it.
Right.
If you trust in God, where is he?
Yeah.
Right? How is God? God's not going to deliver you
or
now.
Do something miraculous, and then I'll finally believe. Well, we know that really doesn't work.
Well, we know Jesus himself said, even if someone rises from the dead, they won't believe.
They won't believe, yeah. They'll just figure it was some kind of trick or something like that. They're not devoid of facts in this matter. They're devoid of will. They will not submit themselves to this man who's king. They will not. So here's where we are. In fact, we're going to leave the passage there today, and we'll come back next time and talk about the actual death of Jesus and strange events that go down at the same time. In fact, this week that we're broadcasting this, earlier in this week, we had a solar eclipse on Monday. And a lot of people who try and argue this away say, well, that darkness that happened on the cross, and we'll see that next week, that was just a solar eclipse. No, it can't be.
It wasn't.
Be.
You can easily track back when eclipses would have happened.
Being a guy who likes science, I also know that on Passover, it's always full moon, which means the moon's on the wrong side of the earth for a solar eclipse. So what happened? We're going to see a lot of those details next week because it's really a fascinating thing that happens when Jesus does finally die after about 6 hours on the cross. So do you have some closing comments for today?
Well, I was just thinking maybe we've got a couple of minutes left. We could read Isaiah 53.
Hey, that's a good idea.
The statement.
And then I have another passage I want to read.
Okay,
so I'll do that real quick.
All right, this will only take us a minute then. I want to start reading actually in Isaiah 52, verse 13. Now, you listeners, listen for all of the things that connect to the crucifixion. Behold, my servant will prosper. He'll be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. Just as many were astonished at you, so his appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Thus he will sprinkle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him, for what had not been told them they will see, and what they had not heard they will understand. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of parched ground. He had no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. Mm. Do you want me to keep reading, or you want
to shift gears here? It is so accurately a commentary on what we're reading here about the crucifixion, that most people presume what you just read came out of the New Testament.
Right.
They're astonished to find out it was put on paper hundreds of years before the crucifixion, and yet it is so accurate. It's one of the most powerful prophecies that come to pass in the crucifixion of Jesus of anywhere in the Old Testament. It's just astonishing. Yeah, read Isaiah 53. And in fact, if you have Jewish friends who wonder about who Jesus is, have them read out of their Old Testament in Isaiah 53. It's an astonishing thing.
I only read
thing.
Half of it.
Yeah,
so
it goes
read
on.
Read to the end of the chapter.
Yeah, I was going to read a passage out of John. Remember in John? John's gospel, Jesus is talking about the fact that he's the good shepherd. Mm-hmm. And he contrasts the good and bad shepherd. We talked about that last time, because the bad shepherd comes to steal, kill, and destroy the sheep. But Jesus says, no, I'm a good shepherd. I lay down my life for the sheep, is what he says in John 10. And in verse 17, he says, for this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it up again. And no one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. No one takes my life from me. So if you look at this account we're reading and think, well, the Jews or the Rome, or they took his life from him. No, he says, no one takes it from me. I lay it down.
I lay it down.
And so this is the good shepherd laying down his life for the sheep that he came to save.
Mm.
And that's what he predicted in John 10. And that's what we're seeing in front of our very eyes right here. Fascinating. It is interesting that Jesus in this last scene is mocked for who he truly is. He's mocked for being the Savior. He's mocked for being of having trust in God. He's mocked for being the Son of God. He's mocked for being a king. And yet all these things are absolutely true. And that's what we see here. We see so much truth coming out in the end of this, and so much fulfillment of prophecy, Isaiah 53, some from the Psalms. I mean, it's all over the place. We're seeing actually truth congeal in this moment, because this is why Jesus was born. He says, this is why I came, in order to give my life for many. And we see it happening right here. This isn't a train wreck. This isn't an accident. This isn't God being out of control. This is the fulfillment of what God has aimed for since the beginning of time, that the Son of God would die for us.
Jesus said, this is why I came, to give my life a ransom for many.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is it. This is it. So we'll come back next time, and we'll see the death of Jesus on the cross and the amazing events that happen concurrent with that, which point to some gigantic truths. And we're going to look that together. It'll be a little uncomfortable, but we'll do it together next time on
More Than Ink.
There are many more episodes of this broadcast to be found at our website, morethaninc.org. And while you're there, take a moment to drop us a note. Remember, the Bible is God's love letter to you. Pick it up and read it for yourself, and you will discover that the words printed there are indeed more than ink.
Well, I'd go for
that. Leave that alone.
That's what happens when you rehearse it.
This has been a production of Main Street Church of Brigham City.